This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Tayama, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Cole Sandberg, who is the founder of Kiraku. Kiraku operates multiple projects that aim to preserve Japan's rich cultural and natural heritage for future generations. Cole has a strong business background with the unique bicultural vantage point of the Japanese tradition. And Cole's diverse projects include transforming abandoned machiya, or traditional Japanese townhouse, in Kyoto into a Michelin-awarded luxury ryokan, and reviving a sake brewery that was founded in 1793, but unfortunately closed in 2012. Now, the brewery became a micro sake brewery to express the rich local terroir. So today, we'll discuss how Kobe came up with the business to preserve Japanese culture and tradition, his intriguing project of hotels and restaurants that you would want to experience on your next trip to Japan, how seriously Japan is losing cultural heritage, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Needs is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Needs. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Cole Sandberg. Hello, Cole. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Akiko. Thank you very much for having me.
So, first of all, let's get to know you. Where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
I was born in Fukushima, Japan. My dad's American, my mom's Japanese. However, mainly grew up in Tokyo, but going back and forth between Connecticut, San Francisco, Bay Area, and Japan. So it's been, you know, I've been moving around every like maybe 4 or 5 years or something. Mainly grew up eating Japanese food. My grandparents in Fukushima are farmers, so they spent a lot of time making good fruits, vegetables, and they always sent us stuff on a weekly basis. So my mom made great washoku out of that.
Wow. And then you spent time in Bay Area, which is also a very good place to eat good food. So you're very lucky.
Yes, slightly expensive than Kyoto.
Right. So, and then you founded Kiraku in 2013. And we'll get into the details in a moment. But what did you do before you started Kiraku?
Upon graduating, I graduated from UC Berkeley back in 2010. And afterwards, I joined a private equity firm, a global private equity firm called Fortress Investment Group. In their Tokyo office as a new grad. And I was mainly handling more of financial products in distressed situations. And I guess this means, in general terms, more like corporate bankruptcies, litigations, and turning around companies that are not really doing well. So a lot of the deals that I was in the past involved in was more like hospitality industry related. So it was more like cleaning up deals that failed during the global financial crisis and more like resolving lawsuits between like families and shareholders and coming up with better solutions to just turn around real estate. And mainly this is where I kind of entered knowing the ryokan business from here.
Right. So you were a change manager already before you started Kiraku.
Yeah. It was more like a just working until 3-4 a.m. every day, just going through documentation and such. But yes, it was a great experience. And I, yeah, started Kiraku from 2013 after that.
Right. So what is the concept of Kiraku and how many projects are you working on right now?
When I initially started, we were doing more of data consulting for hedge funds and corporate clients in Japan. But afterwards, I guess more from 2015 or 16, we were asked for more like to look at into projects in regional Japan to just do it. So like the concept that kind of evolved into Kiraku, what it is right now is we kind of tried to look for hidden gems and business ideas across Japan. And we started working from there. Right now we manage about 4 ryokans and 10 vacation homes. We also own and operate a sake brewery in Nagano. And in parallel, we're working on a few development projects and ryokan turnaround deals that hopefully we could announce sometime in 2022.
Wow, that's a lot of projects. So, and what is your mission in running Kiraku?
Well, it probably comes down to value creation and sustainability, where the current, like, I guess, Japanese ecosystem, we don't really believe is quite sustainable. So in that end, we try to identify unique business opportunities across Japan and hopefully more globally in the future that only not, you know, doesn't only create long-term value for investors, but also for the people in the community so that you could kind of preserve the rich cultural and natural heritage in Japan for more like future generations.
Right. And not to mention, Japan has a long history compared to places like America. So there's a lot to preserve.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. And how did you come up with the concept of Kiraku? Like, you know, there are so many places, potential projects, but it's not easy.
I used to always fly for business, maybe to like Europe or the States, just to do more due diligence and look at projects overseas. But maybe being half Japanese, I always had a connection with Japan, especially in the regional area, to do so. And I guess you know, it's as an investment fund, you have a limited amount of time to just kind of work with projects that doesn't really think about long-term goals or visions. Whereas I guess our strategy on what we want to try to accomplish is to be involved in projects for decades or maybe 2 decades or something, to just be close with the community and also grow with them and just expand from there. And also the thought, I guess Akihiko-san, you might know the term hagetaka, but it's bald eagles looking for distressed deals in Japan. So you would be snatching up. So foreign funds, foreign investment funds, regional Japan, they're kind of scared of foreign investors. They're like, oh, we don't know how to deal with Chinese or American investors. And so they try to kind of avoid it. So we try to be the bridge between, try to come up with a better long-term value creation vision. So not only investors, but the community could also benefit when we are involved in these projects.
Right. You really have rare skill sets and a cultural background too, because there are issues and then in most cases, you don't know what to do. And especially this financial aspect, it's very hard to evaluate what's possible, what is not. So, yeah, you are very precious for Japanese culture preservation, I have to say.
Thank you. Yeah.
Right. So, and the Kiraku in Japanese can mean different things. So why did you name your company Kiraku, and what does it mean?
Well, my senpais or my former colleagues, they think kiraku means laid back, which is the most common way of, I guess, saying kiraku, is to be laid back, easygoing. But I see kiraku as one, the kanji ki might be season, and raku is to enjoy. So one approach is to just look at all the projects that we run. We run projects in Miyazaki and Hokkaido, so we kind of want to have our guests or our clients enjoy the rich and unique seasonality in Japan. So that's our kind of vision that we had in the name Kiraku. Where second is to sort of like enjoy the economic cycle. Not only, we kind of want to focus on strategies, not only looking at the growth cycle, but when, you know, situations like COVID or a global financial crisis happens, we are always prepared and on our toes to just come up with better investment ideas or business ideas so that we don't continue on losing money. So it's, we look at seasonality or cycles, and that's where the name Kiraku came from.
Wow. Okay. I didn't expect this financial cycle, but yeah, it's interesting. Right. Yeah. And then you mentioned, seasons. And when it comes to Japanese culture and especially food culture, seasonality, it means a lot, right? It's not just four seasons. And sometimes there are 24, sometimes they say 72 seasons. And yeah, seasonality is really a big part of Japanese culture. So it's a great meaning and great name for many reasons. Okay, so Japan is known for its unique tradition and culture, but your inspiring business indicates that these values are at risk, seriously. So what are the main causes of the loss of traditional buildings and businesses in Japan?
Well, first, I guess, you know, the population itself is getting older, with the populations now decreasing quite rapidly. And maybe because of, you know, the Japanese bubble during the 1990s, the collapse has really kind of took away the risk takers' motivation in Japan. So I feel like there's not enough risk takers that could just use creative thinking and kind of approach something a little bit differently. Japan is very in line with everyone else. If someone's not doing that, what they should be doing, they'll be punished. And so it's very hard to become the first penguin in this culture, I feel like. Do so. Luckily, I'm half American, so I could kind of use my foreign card, I say, and I say, oh, 大丈夫でしょう, and just try to take the aggressive approach and to push it forward. And so that's one thing. I guess more during the Meiji era and such, Japan used to be like really good at creating unique products, especially maybe post-war as well. But maybe the bubble collapse has really made the country seem to have lost its touch for that case.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I think Japanese people tend to lack confidence in our own culture, right? It's like somebody outside Japan says, oh, this is great. It's like, oh, really? it's more important than we thought. It's like a classic mindset of Japanese people. So, yeah, I think you're playing your role very well.
That's my role. And I have to just be the sensitive foreigner type of a person that just kind of jumps in and say, and once there's track record and, you know, once there's jiseki, then people are, start to get comfortable a lot more, and then they start making more creative solutions. So it's more like, you know, turning around that mentality is quite important, if you like.
Right. Sounds like you're creating the model to follow. So, and it's been working, right? And how serious is the issue of losing traditional buildings and local culture along with it in Japan? It sounds like pretty serious to me.
Well, yeah. So for one example, we have this district called Obi, which is a castle town down in Miyazaki Prefecture in Ichinose City. And it's probably like 3,000 to 5,000 people living there. But however, the buildings, maybe like 15 to 20% are vacant, also known as Akiya. And there's sort of like kind of just left around since kind of like the kids' generation now live in greater Tokyo area and they don't know what to do with the buildings. So they just kind of use it as storage. So there were a lot of culture involved. One was Miyazaki is known for their typhoon seasons and it's quite windy in August and September-ish. So Kawara, which is more like, I don't know how you say it, but the ceilings and such, they kind of use cement-like materials in order to avoid the kawaras from flying around and so. However, the last guy that kind of knew how to make that material passed away, so now the technique is now gone. So if you can't really preserve the building and culture, then the uniqueness of that region is lost. So that's kind of like a sad thing that, you know, happens sometimes and you can't really protect everything. So,
Oh, by the way, Kawara is like a small piece, like a blocks to like a layer over the roof of traditional Japanese houses. And it's a really beautiful design and too bad the people who can make it is disappearing. So, yeah. So, okay. So we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss Ko's inspiring project of saving vanishing tradition and culture even more details. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Ko Sandberg, who is the founder of Kiraku. Kiraku operates multiple projects that aim to preserve Japan's rich cultural and natural heritage for future generations. Okay, so so let's keep talking about your interesting projects. So maybe to start, you have transformed an entire L-shaped alleyway of 24 machiya. So machiya is old traditional Japanese housing, built over 110 years ago, and on the brink of demolition, into luxury ryokan, which has 23 rooms and two restaurants. And the ryokan is called Nazuna Kyoto Tsubaki Street. So how did the project begin and what was the process of the transformation?
So there was this alley, and you don't usually get that much alleys in your direction as a project. Usually you kind of work on one or two houses and life goes on. But every now and so, maybe like once every 2 years, this whole entire alley comes up your direction, and this was kind of the case. This was introduced by one of the a person related with Kyoto City. So this project was based in Kyoto, but the whole L-shaped alley was kind of like on sale, and there were a few potential buyers, but they were kind of trying to demolish everything and develop a new, a business hotel or apartment building to do so. But then was asked by someone related with the city that you know, if we could kind of step in to propose some ideas to preserve the alleyway, because Kyoto is all about alleys. I think Kyoto alleyways are very unique and cool looking, and from a cultural perspective, and it's very hard to come by in the market. And these alleys, you can't really recreate now due to regulations, due to current laws in place. So it's very unique. And this is all just grandfathered because it was built more than 110 years ago. So it's not really like, you know, buying an office building or something like that. So in, I guess, about a week or two, we came up with an idea and we started to do some conversion planning and making a business plan. And I guess within a week or two, we submitted an offer to the owner to purchase the whole alleyway. And in parallel, we were communicating with investors to finance the opportunity as well. And usually, when people think about Kyoto, they think about Gion or Kawaramachi or the central business district. So, and this alleyway was a little bit like far, not so far away. It's just maybe 10 minutes away by cab ride. But a lot of the institutional investors back then really passed on the deal because they didn't really get the idea and they didn't think the location was not that great and such. But a lot of we ended up raising a good amount of money for the project, and now the performance is quite good at this point.
Right. Yeah, it's just amazing. But Kyoto is really, like you said, it's known for alleys, and it's really the representative image of Kyoto. So yeah, I think you really saved a big piece of the history in Kyoto. Mm-hmm. Right. And your newest project is Suginomori Brewery. And you revived a brewery that was born in 1793, but closed in 2012. So tell us about the project.
Okay, sure. So Suginomori Brewery, it's located in Naraijuku, which is a post town in Nagano. And it's actually right between Tokyo and Kyoto. And it used to be one of the post towns when people were transporting, you know, food and such between, at that time, Edo, the prior name for Tokyo, and Kyoto. That was kind of like the midpoint destination between the two cities. And Suginomori Brewery was sort of like sitting in the middle. It was founded in 1793. And however, it kind of closed down in 2012 due to not having a successor. And that's quite big of an issue right now in Japan, that not a lot of business has a person that would succeed the business. And the business is not really being transformed into the hands of the younger generation. So this project, the actual project owner is Takenaka Corporation, which is one of the largest construction companies in Japan. And I was invited, we were invited into this project because they haven't really done some conversions of old houses and ryokan style projects before. So we were initially brought in as advisor to oversee the overall business planning. And initially they were just trying to create a ryokan with only room and restaurant, but we kind of proposed a new idea that they didn't really think of that much, but to just create, since the sake brewing license was still existing, it was dormant and it wasn't gone. So we proposed to use that to make a microbrewery adjacent into the restaurant and kind of so that you could see the sake brewers make some sake while you eat breakfast or something, and thought it might be cool to do so. You usually see things like this in Napa Valley. So in the States, it's like, you know, the norm. But Shiojiri, which is where Narai is located, it's actually one of the major wine-producing areas in Japan as well, in the Shinshu region. However, they're not really good at marketing itself. And I guess that's the main issue. So kind of want to take a new approach and how to transform a micro a sake brewery into a lodging facility with restaurant and to do so. But Takenaka was like, well, we never done it before. So do you want to take over the operation and just do you want to own the company? You could do that and we don't want to take the risk. So I'm like, okay, sure. It's kind of cool to do so. So we start getting advisors on board and such, and we try to do something unique on top of that. Yeah.
Right. But you have experience with hotel management so far, but running a sake brewery is a very different business. So you had to because you proposed it, but why did you decide to get involved in the sake brewing business? It sounds like it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, manufacturing is a completely different field from hotel management. But you know, in the past, I was also involved in logistics, et cetera. So I was kind of used to going across multiple industries and trying to cross everything together to just do something unique. And but sake brewing business has always been one of my interests that I never really approached or executed that much in the past. But I guess the first sake brewery I was analyzing was maybe 10 years ago. That was when I was kind of introduced to the industry. And after that, maybe I usually get introduced to maybe two to three sake breweries per year that is about to go bankrupt. And they asked me if they could get acquired and turn around the business to do so. But usually, you know, I'm not a sake professional. And I love food, but I don't know how to make sake. So and it was very hard to just focus on full time. So never really had the dedication for that. However, Narai, the post town, is actually a well-known tourist destination in the Shinshu area. And thought, you know, I have the expertise in the hospitality industry, so why not blend it with the sake brewing business? So we think about a lot of food pairing with sake and how to kind of make cocktails from sake and try to brew in different methods to do so and kind of expand the horizon from there. But this would probably not have happened if I didn't meet this individual named Hidehiko Matsumoto. He used to be the former master brewer at Matsumoto Shuzo, which is known for the Shuhari brand in Kyoto. So Matsumoto-san, he's actually our advisor on the manufacturing side, so that our team could focus, the manufacturing team could be advised by Matsumoto Shuzo, former Matsumoto Shuzo's Matsumoto-san. And our team at Kiraku could manage more of the management side and focus on there. So we kind of separate the operation between manufacturing and management so that we could kind of focus on what is necessary and who the experts are. They could work well in their environment.
Right. And I heard the new brewery called Suginomori Shuzo is at the highest altitude as a sake brewery. And
yeah.
That's crazy. So, you know, yeah, with your answer, maybe you can tell us what kind of sake the Suginomori Shuzo produces, because, you know, that high altitude probably is like a lot of minerals and beautiful water, and which is very important for sake making, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's also very hard to boil water up there.
Oh.
So that's kind of like the craftsmen that that work in Suginomori Brewery, they're all from Kyoto. So they struggled very hard to get used to with the altitude, because it's completely different from how to brew in Kyoto. So but we kind of focus on more like handcrafted, locally sourced materials. So all the rice is grown in Azumino, which is maybe about an hour and a half away from Narai up north. So I saw your Akiko, I saw your other show from Chris from Matsumoto Jujo. So yeah, they're also in the area as well. So I'm sure they kind of use the vegetables from the Azumino region. But so we kind of use the rice grown over there. But the water itself is from the mountains. So we just use natural mountain water to brew it. And that's how they brewed the sake since 1793. And it seems very unique. Depending on the season, the texture of the water is different due to, I guess, the coldness or the seasonality. So so it's not really septic water or water source to houses, but Narai is quite special. They've been always protecting their water source, and it's all naturally gifted from the highest altitude in the Nagano region. So that's quite nice.
Mm, right. Well, that's another reason I have to go to Nagano, because I have to visit Chris at the Matsumoto Jujo and then drink Narai sake. So the actual label is called the Narai, right? From
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So is it available outside Japan too, or not yet?
I'm still studying. It's possible. So we'll start selling our first batch end of January. So we're just doing some crowdfunding campaign right now domestically, trying to get some marketing done correctly along the way. I guess I'm looking at Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore right now. That seems to be the most easiest market to jump into, since it's a lot closer. The States is always hard with all the state laws and federal laws being right. All different. So I would like to get there. Hopefully soon. And hopefully
Yeah, well, keep me posted. I really want to be the first to taste it. So sounds
yes, good. Please.
And another impressive project you mentioned earlier, but it's the Obi Revitalization Project in Miyazaki Prefecture in Kyushu, which is the southern part of Japan. And it's a large scale, I mean, even bigger than the Ali in Kyoto. It's a regional revitalization project. So how did it come about, and what was the process of the revitalization?
Yeah, sure. So I guess it all started off when one of our investors was kind of asked by the government if he knew anyone that could do something about Akiyas or vacant homes. And we were kind of named up as one of the candidates to become the turnaround coordinators for the project. And after competitions and such, and talking with and doing due diligence on the actual like region, we became the official turnaround coordinator and for the project. And we started drawing up a master plan. And initially, we kind of converted two samurai houses, bukiyashiki, into vacation homes. And these are also maybe 140 years old or something like that, very, very old houses. And we kind of tried to test the waters by making some prototype assets and start from there. And usually kind of want to be considered as the first penguin in the project. So we would kind of be the first one, because all the locals are like, hey, Kosan, you're quite nuts and you can't charge $400 a night for a vacation home, or hotels in the area is like $50 a night. How could you charge $400 to your customer? No one would come. We don't have anything. I'm like, well, you know, please let me do what I do and just see how it's done. But actually, the very unique, interesting thing was it was the first lodging license to be issued in the past 20 years within the city. So you see, you know, hotels being popped up in Tokyo and Kyoto and Osaka, maybe on a weekly basis or something. But in the city, no one has really apply for a lodging permit for the past 20 years. So they forgot how to process it and such. So, but upon starting the operation, occupancy went like quite stable. Maybe it was around 50% occupancy or something. So not that bad as a start. And then the locals were like, oh, it's working. and they started getting more comfortable and such. So then the following year, one of the locals, he started to convert a vacant home into a restaurant. And then another guy started to just convert into a lodging facility as well. So then the locals started to jump in and they're like, well, if Coke could do it, we could do it as well. And I was like, yeah, great. So it actually gave a good vibe because no one was spending money to just put in capital into the town itself to kind of, you know, brush up and polish up the town. But because we were able to make the cycle, you know, several million dollars per year goes into the market, and, you know, that actually feeds the construction workers in the town and the locals as well. And since they usually have about 200,000 people per year as tourists, but no one stays in Obi because there were never a place to stay before. So they're all day trippers. So each individual was spending maybe $7 a day, $7 a person, but our customers were spending maybe $200 per night or something like that. So because, you know, they go out dining, they go out drinking in the town as well. So then the local restaurants were happy about that as well. And from 2022, other larger players are planning to come into the town as well. So JR Kyushu, which is the main transportation train company in Kyushu region, they're planning to open up a lodging facility as well. And JAL, Japan Airlines, they're doing some conversion as well. A little bit more lower rates, but more like casual type of hotel type of a play. So that's kind of like the ramp up that we try to envision, and we come up with a master plan, and hopefully organically, you know, money comes in, other players come in so that, you know, you could have a better market condition that way.
Wow. You totally create a new economy in that small place in Miyazaki Prefecture. That's amazing, right? And the modern area, it's like a market effect. So I'm sure that in a couple of years, that area is almost unbelievably different thanks to your initiation.
Yeah, I guess the first year, maybe the inbound tourists in the market was about maybe 20%. The people that they stayed were from Southeast Asia or East Asia in general. But I guess on our third year of operation, we had about 40 to 50% inbound tourists, but more from European areas and long-term stays. So we had a lot of guests from Europe that stayed with us for like a week or two, and they just read a book in the Enga, and Enga, and the locals are like, "Kosan, that person, he's just reading a book for about a week. What is he doing?" And I tell them, well, that's called taking a break and taking a vacation.
Right. That's classic, right? Because Japanese people tend to go plan, stay, watch, eat, and everything. So you need an Excel spreadsheet to spend a vacation.
It's the opposite. It's so hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned Enga. Enga is a traditional structure in an old classic house of Japan. It's basically, it's facing the garden, and then it's like it functions as a chair or like a bed. You can do anything. You put at the table, you can chat with your neighbor who can just stop by because it's facing outside. So it's kind of like inside outside connecting place. And it's just an amazing space. It's too bad we don't have it anymore in modern Japanese houses. And probably in most Western houses don't have that kind of connecting structure in the house. So yeah, so that's called Engawa. Right. So how do you find your new projects like these interesting, exciting ones, one after another?
Well, some come through real estate brokers, but it kind of ends up becoming a one-time project. So we kind of usually work with more like the central government or municipalities. And I guess a lot more frequent approaches through regional banks, because they're quite the ones in trouble, because they loan money to these companies in the regional area, but they can't really get the money back. So they usually come up to us and say like, hey, we have this problem. They can't pay the money back. Could you do anything about the asset? Because they don't have any idea to do so. So those problem solving, we're kind of usually involved in trying to solve something for them. Or it might just be a direct introduction through a local in Kyoto, or someone from Takenaka Corporation might introduce us to a ryokan turnaround opportunity. So maybe through multiple channels, I would say.
Right. Okay. And so what is the most challenging part of executing your projects?
Maybe finding good talents, because, you know, depopulation in rural areas of Japan is quite a critical issue. You know, people just move to Tokyo, Osaka, and even Kyoto as a destination, but no one really goes back to, let's say, Miyazaki or where they grew up or where they were born. So it's because, you know, they don't really want to succeed their family's business, or there's nothing exciting. So our approach is try to make something always unique and exciting for the talents to kind of commit to, from moving to rural areas from places like Tokyo and Osaka. So I guess that's one approach we really had to take for Shinomori Brewery, because, you know, it is a small town and it's not really for everyone. I'm sure, Ashiko-san, you living in New York, you have this urban desire and such. So it's just very hard for to convince the Kyoto brewers to move to Nagano as well. So those are kind of like always the challenging part, and you really have to create an incentive or create something unique so that they could kind of brag about it as well. So that's always the hard part, finding good talents, I feel like.
Right. So you headhunt and then convince that person for various ways to...
Yes. It's more headhunting, where, you know, the other counterparty in Japan gets really upset sometimes. Because it's headhunting is something that we usually have to do.
But it sounds like the projects you're involved in tend to be very attractive to certain talents, right? Because I know the younger generation sometimes return for the sake of having a unique lifestyle, like trying to appreciate what tradition is about. And yeah, it sounds very hard. I'm sure it is hard, but it's not... I think there could be a certain very specific pool of people who could be very interested in doing that, including outside Japan too. So maybe some of our listeners may contact you too. Can I work there?
Please do so.
Right. So, and what's the most rewarding part of your job at the Kiraku?
I guess it's quite rewarding just to have the feeling of trying to execute something creative that no one has really done before that much. The approach that I usually take is very similar to what we've done in the past in hotel management as well. What we try to introduce into the sake brewing industry is, you know, what was the norm in the hotel industry, but we tried to blend it into the new industry. So I guess just having this this, you know, time and, you know, being able to be creative to just it's just fun to do so. So that's, I guess, the most rewarding part of my job right now. Yep.
Right. So, yeah, there's so many financial projects like what you used to do, but this has, sounds like it's you have to be a designer of the kind of a future. You have to be a visionary to create, because people don't, like you said in Miyazaki, people didn't believe that that's going to happen, and you have to create the vision.
You have to plan the area, you have to understand the law side, you have to understand tax. There's a lot of components that you really have to understand, but once that puzzle kind of fits together and something executes and it actually works as a project, it's very rewarding when that happens.
Right. Well, you've done amazing job already, but how do you evaluate your job so far in terms of the impact on the local business and culture?
So we work with like multiple local businesses and culture before, and it is working quite well, it feels like, but we really have to expand our horizon and try to increase the pace that we do more deals. So as a prototype or a sandbox project, it's been working quite well, and we were able to kind of test a lot of our hypothesis and stuff to just test the water. So it's more of now scaling from this point, where we'll try to go across multiple regions and try to see if we could just put a larger impact into the field. So far it's going well, but so much work ahead right now.
What other project are you working on right now?
So we're working on maybe 6 destinations right now. And there's probably going to be about 4 coming in. So we're understaffed right now. But all the 6 destinations, maybe half is like a ryokan turnaround deal, and the remaining are more like development deals where we would kind of construct from scratch. But it's not only doing one project per property, but you kind of have to envision how you want to focus, how you want to take these destinations into a place. These are all hidden gems destinations that not a lot of inbound tourists or, you know, my friends in the States know. So you kind of want to make the destination unique enough and marketable so that the next time you come to Japan, you're like, oh, maybe I want to go to this place or something like that. So we have like 6 right now, I guess, that are kind of going forward right now.
That's a lot. So, well, in longer term, do you have any plans and dreams?
Well, it's you know, it's baby steps, steps by steps. So like the sake brewery stuff, I just got a call maybe last summer or something like that. So maybe 18 months ago, or 17 months ago. And from there, we kind of stepped into the project. And, you know, if it was early 2020, I would have never thought that we would own a sake brewery and operate our own sake now. But now we'll be distributing from next month. So within a 2-year horizon, you know, the ryokan and the hospitality field was slow for the past 2 years. So it's like, okay, why not export sake then? COVID can't stop that. So those are kind of like the plans. Not really plans, but I don't really have a plan at this point to do so. But it's just more like trying to cross industries together and trying to bridge the relationship between, you know, the U.S. and Japan, trying to get Japan to be noticed a little bit more, because there's so much unique aspects and culture everywhere you go in Japan. So instead of just being Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka for about a week or two, just want to make a unique destination and food and experience culture to just, you know, have fun. So that's kind of like what we're trying to do right now.
I look forward to visiting one or two of your new places because it's really important, like you said. Hidden gems are really hidden. It's like beyond big stations. Like JR station, Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka, Nagoya. Well, you have a very amazing skill sets and talent and sensibility to understand what's important for Japanese culture. So I'm so glad you're doing this amazing job like this. So
thank you very much.
Yeah. So how can we find your updates online and on social media?
We're supposed to update our corporate website because we haven't done it for quite a while. So hopefully we'll launch the new website by February-ish. But meanwhile, we're on Instagram. If it's the Sake Brewery, it's Narai Official is the username. And for our Machiya Ryokans, it's Nazuna Official. Is two of our mainly used Instagram accounts and such. So, and hopefully from February, we'll release more information on our new projects along with the more like the before after website so that we could show more contents to people that might be interested.
Okay, so that's going to be Kiraku, KIRAKU.com or?
.io.
Oh, .io. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay, and your personal account? Anything to follow?
No, I don't have anything to follow right now. So
I don't mind, you're too busy. Yeah. Right. All right. So but thank you so much for joining us today, Ko. And I know you're recording from one of your properties, like project properties. Right. So, and thank you for staying up so late. Thanks so much.
No worries. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next week.
Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.